Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the 1990s discussion portion of The Failure of Socialism. Milton Friedman is joined by guests Dr. Gordon Tullock of the University of Arizona and Dr. Henry Levin of Stanford University to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of The Failure of Socialism. Listen now and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Welcome to Free to Choose. Joining Dr. Friedman tonight for a discussion on what's wrong with our schools are Dr. Gordon Tullock, who is professor of economics and politics at the University of Arizona, and Dr. Henry Levin, who is professor of economics and education at Stanford University. Dr. Levin, let's start with you. What's wrong with giving parents the choice where to send their children to school?
Oh, I like the idea of giving parents the choice of where to send their children to school. Within the public sector and schools that are concerned about the social benefits of education, that is creating a society where there's a common set of knowledge, social cohesion, and so on. So that would be my goal.
Dr. Friedman, what's wrong with public school choice?
There's nothing wrong with public school choice. There's something wrong with limiting choice to public schools. Public schools should not be in a monopoly position. They should have to compete with private schools. If you want to know what's wrong with public school choice, just look at the post office and see what's wrong with giving the government a monopoly in delivering first-class mail. Why should a parent be restricted to using his tax money and the tax money that's assigned to him by others simply in those schools that are run by the government?
At the first place, the last letter that Milton Friedman wrote to me took 5 days to get from San Francisco to Tucson. This is a byproduct, but nevertheless true. But secondly, you've got to remember, we let the parents make a lot of choices with respect to education by voting in the school boards or voting the people who elect the school boards. We let the parents decide whether we should have military forces in Iraq, this being a democracy. I don't see why we shouldn't let them make the decisions by themselves instead of indirectly.
Well, my concerns here are the following. By the way, I should mention to you that in Palo Alto, where I am a member of the school board, so I can be your bureaucrat here, we have just voted in a policy that all graduates of Palo Alto high schools, we have two of them, will be proficient in foreign languages. That will be a requirement for graduation. There's no private school in the country, to our knowledge, and we've made an extensive search that sets that kind of standard.
Why shouldn't there be? Why should you? Be able to tell John and Jane that they necessarily have to be proficient in a foreign language. Maybe they'd rather be proficient in music or in mathematics or in something else. I don't see that that's anything for you to boast about. Mm-hmm. It's just a demonstration of your willingness to replace their judgment by yours.
But then you'd have to tell me what are your social concerns about schooling, because to justify public funding for elementary and secondary schools, surely there are social benefits that are worth paying for. Otherwise, no one should expect the government to pay for schools.
Well, you've raised a very good question, because in fact, I have become increasingly doubtful whether there is any case for government funding of schools. But the argument has always been that you need people who can read, write, and do arithmetic, who have some knowledge of history and of the society, in order to have an educated citizenry in which a democracy can operate. And I think there's a great deal of sense to that.
Should we agree on ways of making decisions in the public sector? That is, should people have some notion that, in fact, we do have a system of government, that, in fact, we do debate issues,
yes,
ultimately we take votes on issues and work?
Tell me how that's related to being proficient in a foreign language.
Oh, the foreign language is one concern. In other words, that's a concern that
I have. Well, where does that, how is it justified?
The foreign
on
language
the grounds
or knowledge of government processes.
Excuse me, I agree with you that you need some knowledge. And I agree that in any system in which the government is going to provide money for people to go to school, it is not inappropriate that they should specify certain minimum requirements in spending that money. And I would agree with you that one of those minimum requirements would be some knowledge of the mechanisms of government. But it certainly doesn't include proficiency in a foreign language, and yet that's what you're proud of.
But then what you say, that we're in agreement on the principles that we should specify certain criteria for schools, but on the other hand, you're saying that parents should just have a choice of a school regardless of what it does.
And no.
This is my understanding.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Could I interrupt? In the latter part of the 19th century, The schools were subsidized. You could, in England, you could send the children anywhere you want, but the subsidy depended on how many children passed certain specific examinations. If 90% passed, you got a high subsidy. If 10% passed, you got a very low subsidy. You could have complete private, and these may, a lot of, many of these were church schools and private schools. You could have a very large degree of autonomy and a control of what is actually taught just by this examination. Very simple procedure.
Dr. Jellick, don't we have exactly the opposite of that now? We now fund schools, schools that have disadvantaged students who may in fact not be doing well get more money.
Well, no, that would have been true in England too. The special problem of disadvantaged students is a very real one, and I don't think anybody feels that they should be treated exactly like students who aren't. The question really is the technical way of dealing with them, and that is not an easy question. He's an educator. Let him answer that one.
But I want to go back to this other question. You can provide, the government can provide money without mm-hmm. producing the product on which the money is spent. In fact, most of its money is spent that way.
Yeah.
The government gives people food stamps with the requirement that it be used to buy only food. But the government doesn't run the grocery stores in which they buy the food. There is no contradiction between saying we give a parent a voucher, which may be used only for buying education in schools which satisfy these minimum requirements. There's no contradiction between that and saying that schools may be privately run. They may be run by churches, they may be run by corporations for profit, they may be run by nonprofit organizations of parents or what else.
Sure, as long as you set the common standards, and the question is this, if you set the common standards high enough, you're going to get schools precisely like the peasant ones. You won't even allow public choice among schools.
Wait. You set the standards high enough, you'll get schools like our present ones? I would say if you set them low enough, you get schools like our present ones.
In terms, not the specific criteria, what I'm saying is if you set them in great enough detail.
If you insist that they must be able to read, you'll get a different kind of school.
For example, I hear you talking about perhaps a national examination,
yes.
And yet what we're hearing is that we ought to have choice.
No,
that
I would disagree with that. I disagree
He and I don't always agree on everything, even if we're both wearing Adam Smith ties.
No, I get very confused by this because people like Bill Bennett and like Alan Bloom and E.D. Hirsch talk about we need a common culture and we need to get greater common content in schools, and they even talk about a national curriculum and national examinations.
But after all, Bill Bennett was Secretary of Education. I do not expect the Secretary of Education to be in favor of private schools any more than I expect the Postmaster General to be in favor of giving up the monopoly of distributing mail.
But yet he is. He feels that he is in favor of private schools, and he certainly is in favor of choice between the public and private
sector.
Yes,
he is in favor of choice between them, I agree. But, of course, the problem is what we mean by high standards. Mm-hmm. I believe that marketplace produces higher standards than government does in every area. I don't know any area. No. The marketplace produces higher standards in delivering mail, as we have found out from Federal Express and from the other private mail companies, than the government does. The marketplace, if left to itself, if not hindered, if not restricted too much, will produce higher standards in schools. That's why I want them. That's why I'm in favor of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question then. In a recent period, 34% of the babies born in San Francisco General Hospital, which as you know is the largest public hospital in San Francisco, were crack addicted babies. Tell me about their parents and how they'll make educational choices for their children and in the interest of their children.
Could I ask if they make educational choices by voting for the school board, would it be just as bad?
Well, my concern right now is I do have an alternative. If you go to the Daniel Webster School, again right here in the city, you'll find a school in the public sector with decentralized control and accountability, with the largest gains in test scores this past year in the city of San Francisco. So I would maintain that reform is possible within the public sector. You need vast decentralization, and the only issue is whether that's possible politically, and I suspect we could discuss that.
Well, would these mothers, these children you were talking about, would they go to Daniel Webster?
Yeah, that's very important because, see, Daniel Webster is in the area where there is a public housing project, the Potrero Hills housing project, and it's precisely those neighborhoods that produce these crack-addicted babies.
So would the crack-addicted, you're concerned about the crack-addicted mother producing crack not being able to choose a private school. Why can she choose a public school?
Well, in this particular case, I think they're fortunate to be in that neighborhood where we've tried to start this kind of decentralized approach
aren't you really
to accelerating
saying that,
education.
Aren't you really saying that the choice has been made for them and that you're therefore confident of that?
Not only has it been made for them, but I think it's a very good choice that's been made for them, because these particular families are under tremendous stress and simply do not seem to place a high priority on educational decisions.
But I think the great defect in the kind of talk we're hearing from you is the attempt to treat 100% of the people one way because 5% of the people have to be treated differently. There are disadvantaged children like the crack babies. And as Gordon was saying before, they cannot be treated like everybody else. I quite agree. No question. But I would like to have a system in which 90% of the parents, that 90% which will make sense, which we do trust in every other way to be responsible for their children, that 90% has the greatest opportunity to provide their children with the kind of schooling that they will benefit their children most. And we have special treatment for the 10% falling out. Now, you take your public school or government school in San Francisco. Of course there are exceptions in the public school system. There always have been. We showed one in the film of the school outside Boston, which was a very good school for a different reason. The problem is they don't last. And the problem is that they cannot become general because there is no mechanism for getting rid of the bad schools. There's no effective accountability. And the only effective accountability you can have is the right of the customer to say, I won't buy or I will buy.
Let me ask another question, Dr. Friedman. What about the schools? Will they be required to take all children once the parents have made the choice?
No, not at all. Any more than restaurants are required to admit all customers.
Well, they are required to admit all customers on the basis of race.
There yes, I would in that case. I'm saying that the use of the voucher can be contingent on certain requirements. And I think it is generally agreed that non-discrimination with respect to race would be one of them. Now, it's an interesting thing, in fact, that in the private religious schools, the Catholic religious schools, they tend, on the whole, to have a larger mixture of minorities than most so-called public schools. And the reason is very simple. The minority parents get such bad schooling in the areas where they are that even though many non-Catholics, for example, the proportion of blacks in Catholic primary schools is very high. I've forgotten what it is. But they get a better schooling there. Mm-hmm. They feel they have better discipline.
And they're willing to pay for it.
And they're willing to pay for it.
But if that's true, it's interesting that the Coleman results show that although the private schools outperform the public schools academically, it's by a very small amount. That is, the private schools adjusting for race and social class are about the 52nd percentile relative to the public schools being at the 50th percentile. And what's of interest to me is why is it that 48% of private school children are performing below the average for public school children?
The answer to that is that you have only a very limited degree of competition in the private schools. The Catholic schools and the parochial schools in general have a comparative advantage over strictly private schools. Here you have somebody down the street who's giving something away for free, and you're going to try to sell it. It's kind of difficult to do. The Catholics, or the Christians, the other forms of Christian schools or Jewish schools, any of the parochial schools, are part of an institution which is willing to subsidize that process. And therefore, there is only a very small area of strictly private profit market-oriented schools. Mm-hmm. And if you had that, I think the performance would go up enormously. If you look at certain areas where you do have private schools, like in training television technicians and the like, they perform extremely well.
No, we have to talk about that sector because that's a very interesting sector. The guaranteed federal loans, as you know, apply to the post-secondary proprietary schools as well as colleges and universities. And a whole sector has risen to serve the poor.
And that sector, but those guaranteed loans have become a scandal.
That's absolutely right. And they become a scandal mostly in this post-secondary sector, post-proprietary institutions that serve the poor. They get them to sign these forms.
Of course,
and you know this.
It's terrible.
The system,
it's disgraceful.
And there are 70 to 80% loan defaults that all of us at this table are paying for. Of course, they're very small relative to the savings and loans debacle. But in fact, there's a market, and people are making choices.
But I'm not, I'm not in favor of that system, as I said before. And I'm not in favor of the government subsidizing the people who are going into higher education. That's a very different question.
But it does show how a market would work when people are given the power of a voucher
when
to
they
purchase
spend
education.
Somebody, yes, but the point is they're not spending their own money. They're not spending the money that is being provided to them. Let's take a very different case.
If people who are permitted to borrow money and not pay it back will do badly in any place. I think we can agree there is a government function, which is making people who borrowed money repay their debts. Whether the debts are borrowed for that purpose or to buy a car.
What is the distinction between higher education and elementary and secondary education?
Very simple. Elementary and secondary education is compulsory.
And you would favor that?
No, I don't. At one point I did favor it. But the more I have studied it, the more I have believed that the extent of schooling that would be voluntarily attained would be large enough so that there would be no additional advantage in compelling the small number who are left. That is, if without compulsion, only 50% of children would go to school, then I would have to say compulsion should be justified because of the importance of having a school population. But I have become persuaded that if there were no compulsion, 90% of the kids would go to schools. And therefore, I no longer see the necessity of compulsion.
This, in fact, was true in England before they introduced the public school system. Ed West, I think it's higher than 90. I think it's 95 or 97%.
It was his work that persuaded me of it.
Yeah, well, it's okay. But he also looked at the United States, and it's very hard to get this in the United States because of the state, different
state
states
by state.
Different.
The schooling of children occurs at the intersection of two basic rights. One is the right for me to bring up, and I have five children and a grandchild, but the right for me to bring up my children the way that I see fit. The other right is the right of a nation to school its children or to reproduce values and attitudes and knowledge that help to sustain the particular things, including respect for these various amendments that the nation stands on. It would be wonderful if there were no conflict between the two, but the fact of the matter is we know historically there has been conflict between the two, and the question is how we're going to resolve that conflict.
But at the moment, I think the conflict is produced by the public school system. I think it is disgraceful. But this is, as I understand it, the first generation in American history that is going to be more poorly schooled than its parents. And I see no way you can defend and say that somehow this conflict you've described can justify the kind of school system we have, and you don't.
Well, I'm trying to look, though, for your insights into how we solve this, because we agree on the problem. The question is the solution. Now, American children apparently watch 19 and a half hours of television a week, according to one of the Gallup polls that I saw. Japanese children watch about 2.5 hours. I think we agree that commercial children's television is not what we'd like it to be educationally.
They usually watch adult television.
That's even worse.
But are you talking about more control rather than less control?
Well, the question that I have is this. The same parents now who simply derogate responsibilities for most of the education of their children outside of the school to a TV set that's showing inane kinds of experiences are the same parents who are very sensitive and concerned. I think we have to help them to become better parents. I think we have to work with them. But I don't think that
Who's the we?
I think that all educational professionals are responsible for working with parents and for children.
The educational professionals who are going to make any decisions of this sort are those who have either directly or indirectly been selected by the parents. You've got to remember this is a democracy. We vote for these things.
We all agree on the critical importance of education. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion and that it will continue to provoke your thoughts on who should choose our children's school. Next week on Free to Choose, we'll be discussing an issue of critical importance to the founding of this nation, equality and the rights of the individual.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.